This is Outline After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 408 for February 9th of 2018, Corvettes, Teslas, the Super Bowl, and Dalai Lama. Watch Outline After Hours live at outline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Outline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Outline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Well, welcome everybody to another episode of Outline After Hours. Unfortunately, Gary Vasilash is not with us today. He's a little bit under the weather. But you're going to have a taste of Gary in the show anyway, because he gave me some great topics and questions that we're going to be getting into. But with Gary not being here, we got a couple of good people that are with us anyway. Chris Pockert with Roadshow by CNET, back here yet again.
Yeah, I keep coming back for some reason.
There's only one reason why you keep coming back, dude. We like having you here.
Thank you. I like being here.
And we've got Phoebe Howard with the Detroit Free Press. And Phoebe, great to have you here.
Thank you.
This is your sort of maiden voyage, as it were, on Outline After Hours.
Yes.
But cool to have you here.
It's a pleasure.
And our special guest today is Don Runkle. Don, it says you've been on the show before.
Yes.
I'd forgotten all about that.
Right.
But that was a few years ago.
A few years ago, I think, on the engine that I was working on.
Yeah, well, and we're going to get into that in a minute. But it says here you're with Runkle Enterprises. What the hell is that?
That's just a little consulting company when I don't have anything else to do. So.
But just for people who don't know your background, I think I first met you way back in the last century.
You made me famous. You put me on the cover of...
Automotive Industries magazine, which I ran at the time. But I think when I first met you, could this be right? You were the head of advanced engineering at Chevrolet Engineering or Chevrolet Powertrain, something like that?
Yeah, I had advanced engineering at the CPC at the time, the Chevy Pontiac Canada group. And before that, I think when I was chief engineer, I went from being chief engineer of Chevy to that job. So it was right in and around that time frame. And then about a year and a half later, I became vice president of advanced engineering for the corporation. And then all of engineering after that for some time. So,
and that was your GM career. Then you spent a lot of time at Delphi
as well. We helped lead the spinoff of Delphi out of General Motors. We tried three times, and finally the third time was the charm. So that was good. And then I ended up running... I don't know, probably 50, 60% of Delphi at the time, the engine management group, chassis, so forth, and then ended up being vice chairman and CTO and head of lean enterprise stuff at Delphi. So,
and then you retired from that, and you've been dabbling in all these high-tech companies.
Yeah, I went from that, didn't become CEO, and Steve Miller came in and led it into bankruptcy. So it was a good time to not be there since it stayed in there for quite a while. And ended up, I think a month after I left Delphi, I ended up at Tenenbaum Capital, which I'm still with. They're a private equity company out of Santa Monica. And then got recruited CEO of an engine company, got involved in a number of different ventures by different venture capitalists and so forth. And now I'm on the board of a couple companies. Lear is one of them. VIA Motors, Bob Lutz is the chairman of that. So I'm on that, and then I serve as an advisor typically to boards or the CEO of a few others. So I have, I guess, seven different companies I work with right now.
And there goes your phone. I should have told you to turn that off before the show started.
He's a popular guy.
Yeah, right now.
It's one of those seven boards. So I wanted to ask you the question. What's more exciting? Is it getting to dabble in different things now and having your fingers in lots of pies, or did you really like the focus of something like, you know, advance at GM?
I think it all was exciting all the time, frankly. When I joined GM way back in the Stone Ages, we were into solving the emissions issue. Fuel economy was a big deal there, and lots of laws and so forth. Safety was enormous, you know, lots of barrier crash stuff. My first job at GM was simulating barrier crashes, so we didn't have to crash the cars into the barrier, but do it on the computer. And so that was all exciting. And then as I moved along, we got much more involved in racing and performance, Chevy racing and so forth, Buick racing. And then I did lots of concept cars and so forth. They're always exciting because you pick a topic and try to push the envelope, whether it's an electric vehicle or high performance like the Serve 3 or something like that. And then I would say, though, when I left the big companies, General Motors followed, Delphi was a big company also, I found the venture world is just fascinating. And then as I got engaged in that, I was given opportunities in industries other than the automotive arena. And that opened my eyes to a lot of other things. You know, I'm involved in the nuclear energy business right now, in the software business. And, autonomous vehicles and artificial intelligence was one of the companies I'm working with right now. And so I just can't. And right now, I mean, if I were just coming out of college today, I'd absolutely go into the auto industry. I mean, with all the stuff that's going on. And we're right at the verge of a revolution, whether it's autonomous or I don't want to say electric vehicles, but electrification of powertrain. Because that's clearly helps with the fuel economy and so forth.
When you talk about, you just made reference to your areas of expertise, and you said...
I don't know if I'm experts, but I got involved.
The landscape, right? So you talked about the emissions, and you talked about safety, and that's all. And the fuel efficiency, it's a whole new world, yet still revisiting the areas that...
Yeah. Yeah, I know when I was head of advanced engineering at GM, I made a speech because we had just purchased used aircraft. And I thought, that almost ought to be illegal. No one should be able to buy a company with that technical capability. Mm. But Roger Smith had that as one of the Lulus, and we ended up with it. And I was sort of the gatekeeper between the aerospace guys and General Motors. How do you bring this fabulous technology into the automobile business? And so I went out and made a speech, and I said, what we should do jointly between our companies, obviously we own them, but we should do it, is we should have cars that are not in the environmental equation. So effectively zero emissions. And I wasn't picking a technology, whether it was electric or internal combustion engines. We should have cars that do not have accidents, can't happen, so that we don't have any accidents out there. Today, there's 1,200,000 worldwide deaths due to the
motor vehicle accidents.
Motor vehicle accidents. I mean, can you think of a product that would be legal that killed, a million people a year? So maybe talk about gun laws.
Yeah, right.
So that was a second challenge. And then the whole issue of not connectivity, but this congestion topic. How do we not have congestion and so forth? And still, those are very relevant today, and trying to bring the technology that Hughes had at the time into GM. And we had some minor successes, but the cultures were so different between the aerospace guy. I remember one of the guys at Hughes, just a terrific guy. He says, "Uncle, we don't understand your business." He says, "Here you guys spend $2 billion. You build prototypes, you build factories and all that, and then you put it out and see if anybody actually wants to buy it." At Hughes, we sell it first, and then we get the government to pay for us to figure out how to actually do what we sold.
Well,
that sounds a lot better. He says, "We know we have the customer. We already sold it."
Well, that's sort of the Tesla model right now, right? They've pre-sold, or at least they've got all the hand raisers, and they've collected deposits on a lot of things, and they're just starting to build the cars now.
Yeah.
And by the way, they're in aerospace, too.
Yeah, right.
So what do you make of Tesla as a car company? What are your thoughts?
Well, they need to get to the point where they actually do make profit. And I read this morning, they burned through quite a bit of cash over the last year. And the last quarter, I guess, was a record loss. So they have to get to that point. I think the product seems fine. But my feeling is, and I've always felt this way, that the major players now are into that role. So the guys that never screw up a car.
Here comes the Porsche Mission E, in other words.
Well, here comes the Mercedes and General Motors, and everyone is engaged. And I'm not saying it's all going to be electric. I mean, Tesla
Jaguar
is committed to
That's
electric.
That's what everyone's waiting for, yeah.
Where many of the OEMs will have electric, but they'll have electrified powertrains. And, right. You know, most of these 20, 30 years from now, we'll still all have internal combustion engines.
And by the way, they'll also have profitable vehicle lines already to defray the cost of developing those electric vehicles.
Yeah.
And they have the infrastructure in terms of dealership networks and such.
And they'll have terrific cars.
They have quality. Yeah.
And there's a lot of things in the Teslas. We were just talking about the fit and finish and stuff like that.
Before the show, we were saying that the fit and finish on them are not very good.
Yeah, I mean, you would never get a car like that out of the big guys now. They're fabulous quality, whether it's General Motors or Ford or Mercedes or you name it. It's hard to buy a bad car today. And so these guys won't mess that up. And my feeling is Tesla doesn't have any particularly technology. They would certainly disagree. Any particular technology that most everybody in the car business don't already know, and whether it's the control electronics or how motors work and how that should get better. Nothing particularly earth-shattering in the battery arena.
That may be true, but, over-the-air updates, they were the first to be able to do that. No one has caught up, not even close to them. They put that giant screen in the Model S, 10 years ago? When did that thing come out? And no one's caught up to them on that. So even though the industry may be aware of what Tesla's got, there are two items of technology that no one's even come close to catching up to them on.
Yeah, as long as you want to catch up on those, I would entertain. There's a lot of smart car companies out there, and if they didn't do that, it wasn't because they didn't know how to do it. They just might have a different view on whether that is the thing that now makes you innovative and terrific. I don't know if I need a 12x12 screen.
It's cool, man. I'm telling you, it's really cool.
Well, you got the new
cars.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, it doesn't sell many
cars. All the big vehicles have. Everyone
Let's get serious about the sales.
Yeah.
Well, how many are they selling?
Well, they sold last year. They just sold over 100,000 cars.
Mm-hmm.
But you know,
100 million a year.
I know. But you know, I think their sales were up like 38%.
That's easy when you have small numbers.
Well, I suppose.
Seriously.
What you were saying, Phoebe? What?
Well, on that note, I like to ask people, you know, when you think about F-150s, you know, that in a whole year Tesla produces, right, that are profitable. But it's an amazing concept that what a Detroit automaker builds in 1 month and what others build an entire year.
Yeah.
I mean, the standards and application. You asked about Tesla being an auto company, and Tesla does not want to be considered an auto company.
Oh, that's right.
It's like a dirty word.
Yeah, they're selling the brand.
Tech company.
They certainly don't behave like a traditional automaker in any sense of the word, from PR on down to, you know, it's...
Yeah, I admire what the company has done there with that, but I do think in terms of innovation and stuff like that, I don't see particularly anything that's, you know, frankly, the controls... And the way they did the electric motor is all the stuff right out of the GM EV1. And if you don't believe me, ask the guy at Tesla, J.B. Strobel.
Yeah.
I think they did do a lot of innovative thinking for a while. I think their window of opportunity is closing.
Well, you got a lot of heavy artillery coming into that space now. And I think the GM Bolt's a good example of a very high quality, good numbers the whole way around. And and outperforms the Teslas in many regards.
It does, but and I'm not going to diss the Bolt. I think it's a terrific car. It doesn't have $400,000 or 400,000 customers putting down a deposit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's the one thing that Tesla's done a brilliant job.
Yeah, they have
with zero marketing. Essentially, they've got people standing in line to buy their cars.
Yeah, but just keep in mind, let's make sure we know what the volumes really are and what they have done there. They're tiny, and EVs are not a big factor in the...
So what do you think is going to happen with the electric car market?
As they get the gas tank to cost less, I think they'll have a bright... the battery. I mean, what is it?
Okay,
now? Couple hundred dollars per kilowatt hour. So what's the Bolt's got a 60 kilowatt hour battery, 60 times 200, that's $12,000 battery.
Yeah.
Or $12,000 gas tank. Gas tanks usually cost around $100 or so, and they don't wear out. And to fill up a gas tank of a Bolt, if it were internal combustion engine, what would it get, 40 miles per gallon, something like that? So it'd cost you $15 to get 238 miles, which is what the Bolt gets. And probably to fill up the tank of an electric car costs $3 or something like that for 10 cents a kilowatt hour or something like that. But you got to pay for the $12,000 gas tank. I figured it out this morning at breakfast. That takes 25 years. So I'm not too worried about the internal combustion engine being hanging in there.
So
just because, you know, and I was the co-founder of the United States Advanced Battery Consortium with the Department of Energy, and we brought GM, Ford, and Chrysler in. Because when we did the GM EV1, the impact which led to the EV1, you know, it was clear the problem was with the electric vehicles is the battery costs too much. It wears out, and it simply is the range issue. And so we created the, you know, my point to the other two guys, GM and Ford and Chrysler, is let's pool our resources to see if we can't find better batteries. We don't compete on gasoline. Mm. So let's not compete on batteries. Let's compete on my electric car is better than your electric car, and because mine's green and yours is purple and that sort of stuff. And but let's get the price of the battery down, the cost of the battery and so forth, to the point where it could be a viable alternative to gasoline. So we picked the number of $100 per kilowatt hour all in. That's not just the cells. That's the whole battery.
The pack.
And a lot of times you hear quotes and you got to dig in and find out, you're talking cells, because it's about 50% different in those. And so that's where the $100 target came from. And they're starting to sniff around that number. You know, I don't know where it is today, probably a couple hundred, maybe. You hear lots of different numbers. I'm in a company that we actually buy electric vehicles, so we see at least what we have to pay for them, and it's not close to $200 per kilowatt hour. So anyway, I think battery costs have to continue to come down, and all the other things of faster charging and things like that. But they've made good progress in that. They've got reasonable range now. And so it's not, you know, when we brought out the GM EV1, we had, 23 miles of range. You know, we had 800 pounds of lead acid batteries because that's what we had.
But when you're looking at the markets and who's buying and who's interested, even when you go to the tiniest towns in California, the agriculture communities, all the malls, all the shopping have charging stations. I mean, the places you would least expect. So California is ready, and it goes to, you know, if you buy it, do you ignore that? A lot of people say
I would not ignore it. I think everybody should have one and do it. I'm just saying, will it become the internal combustion engine of the next 25, 30, 40 years? And I don't believe the numbers would support that because of cost of the gas tank.
Hey, we got a phone call here on a topic that I wanted to talk about, Corvette. Let's bring that in, Carmen.
Hey guys, all excited about today's show. Mr. Runkle and Chris, I have a question for you guys. Do you think it costs a manufacturer any more to produce on a dedicated platform a front mid-engine car versus a rear mid-engine car? Either version would be a dedicated platform to that vehicle. Shouldn't the manufacturing costs be relatively close? As an example, say a C7 Corvette and a C8 Corvette. Of course, we don't know what's going on, but just curiosity. I was wondering if the production costs of the two vehicles would be somewhat similar. Thank you very much, and I'm waiting with bated breath to watch today's show. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Jonathan.
Yeah, my experience, and I did...
You did a lot of Corvettes.
A lot of Corvettes. Not me personally, but my teams at Advanced Engineering and Chevy and so forth. So we did the Serve 3, which mid-engine. We did the Chevy Indy, which was mid-engine. So we always had to do a mid-engine Corvette, and then we'd come back to reality and actually go with the front-engine configuration. And our studies would say that the mid-engine configuration, right or wrong, turned out to be more expensive. But that really wasn't the reason for going that configuration. The Corvette already has a roughly a 50-50 weight distribution. The the mid-engine configuration would be a little easier to tip in going into turns and so forth. So I think it comes down. Typically, mid-engine vehicles have less functionality, so to speak. Where do you put a couple bags of golf clubs? And because once you give the designer the idea that you can put a low hood on because you don't have the engine up there, he will do it. He will take it down, and now there isn't any room up there. So typically, most mid-engine configurations have less functionality. And I'd say the Corvette has had great functionality over the years, given the performance that it has. So
fabulous.
I'm a big fan of the configuration. Yeah. When we moved the transmission to the rear, that helped the weight distribution, which we did on one of the versions, and it's there today. And the power today, it runs with anybody out there, whether you're mid-engine or front-engine. So the performance is much different than 20 or 30 years ago, where mid-engine cars would run circles around front-engine cars. So, but that's not the case
today. So what is it that cost more? And you know, you did the analysis.
It's just where the cooling system is, and you got to get it to the engine and so forth. With a front-engine car, it's there. So that's less. And then sometimes, because of the way you do that, you end up with more fans and more cooling there. I'd say I think the transmission configuration is a little more marginally more expensive. You know, probably Dave McClellan or somebody will call in, so now you're all wet in this stuff. But at least the studies we did those times. But we weren't deciding to go one way or the other based on cost. When we did the C4, when we put lots of aluminum in the structure and basically changed the Corvette position even in the marketplace, substantially increased price and so forth. We recognized we had a great brand, and people were asking for more performance and be able to run with the big guys in Europe and so forth. And we did that, and the price changed pretty high. There was a lot of angst whether that would fly or not, but we were also doing stuff with the Camaro at the same time to sort of fill anybody that didn't want to go to the vet. They had a good choice with the Camaro. So I'd say there was some marginal cost penalties there, but it didn't matter to us, actually.
Yeah, I think the practicality among vet buyers is really important. A lot of those guys, they talk about things like, you know, how much they can get in the back. And yeah, Actually, oddly enough, their fuel economy. They all love talking about fuel economy, vet owners.
Because it's pretty impressive.
It is. Oh, both of those things are
pretty impressive. I bought my wife one for her birthday. And, you know, you're driving down at 70 miles per hour. You look down, it's running on V4s. Must be getting 30, 40 miles per hour. I said, this is ridiculous. It's a 450 horsepower engine. Yeah. Does 200 miles an hour. It's getting 35 miles per gallon.
So that's pretty good.
Yeah. I saw you had the Serve 3 up there. So
yeah.
That was
the blue car that we had the picture
car
up
yeah,
there.
Yeah, exciting car. That was mid-engine. We took the ZR1 engine and put a bunch of turbos on it, and we had nearly 800 horsepower in that. Full high bandwidth active suspension, compliments of Lotus.
Talk about that a little bit, because that active suspension was phenomenal.
Yeah. I would say in all of my years, and I've driven millions of different cars and so forth, there was nothing that has made a bigger impact on me on particularly ride quality with and even gaining on handling capability as a full bandwidth, high bandwidth, which means the number of hertz of cycles there that it'll participate at was very high. Was the full bandwidth high bandwidth active suspension? You'll remember Ayrton Senna won the Detroit Grand Prix with an active suspension Corvette or active suspension Lotus, and you know, we had a 25 horsepower hydraulic pump in the thing. I wish we'd have put it on the Cadillac instead of the Vette. Now, my first love was the Vette, but it was a hell of a packaging problem because you had all these high pressure hydraulic hoses running around. You had load cells in every cylinders, and we would power the shock absorbers. We weren't waiting for stuff to happen.
So in other words, just so those in the audience not familiar, this is not like electromagnetic rheological adaptive shocks. You're putting power.
We are putting a lot of power into individual corners, and you know, you can do things. You can bank into a turn if that turns you on. You can almost lift the wheel up. So whenever you're going over whoop-de-doo, so to speak, and so forth, the Vette or the active suspension just goes through that as if you were
were on a flat road.
On a flat road. And I remember I sold this to our top management at the time. And I had a video that was the one that did the job. I had one of our lady engineers, and I said, "Here, go around one of the courses here at the, which had a lot of whoop-de-doos at the proving grounds." And I said, "In one hand, hold this glass of water." And so she goes blasting around this thing and comes back, and the water, she is soaked. And the glass is totally empty. I mean, it just, you know, just all over the place. And I said, then jump in the active vet, same thing, full glass of water, didn't spill a drop.
Wow.
And that was the closing argument. I says, guys, that's it.
But nobody's done an active suspension.
No one has done an active suspension. There's a lot of things. Clear Motion has some interesting stuff going on out there. With shock absorbers, Bose had a system. So they've all messed around with it. But no one's put in 25, 30 horsepower of hydraulic capability into those things. And there were some technical issues. We were headed for production. We had a production-approved program at GM to put it on the Corvette. But we ran into a technical problem called impact harshness, you know, tar strips and stuff like that we could not manage to acceptable levels. And we began putting so much rubber in the system, then we lost control of what we were in there for in the first place. So we folded it. But I always thought someone should continue the development of that and solve the one issue we had. Because today, you know, driving around, just I was coming in from the airport the other day, and you're smashing around in the back of a car and stuff like that.
Yeah, the roads are worse.
Where are we? And today, the roads are crying for active suspension.
Well, and I think as we move toward autonomy, that sort of suspension discipline and keeping, you know, ride motions to a minimum is going to be more and more important.
Absolutely, because, I mean, in these autonomous vehicles and so forth, you're going to be doing homework, you're going to be looking down, you're going to be getting car sick. And I think you don't need to go to a full active to help that particular problem. There's some good systems that are being developed right now, which I think will come out in the next few years that will help in that arena. But this moving of the head and so forth and looking down at your computer screen is a good opportunity for, you know, development there.
What's been the chief impediment there? Is it cost? Is it packaging? Is it reliability? Is it weight?
Cost is a big one. This was a very expensive system. You got a powerful motor. You got high pressure hydraulic lines, steel braid, and so forth. The packaging of it, the load cells are very expensive in every corner. And the let's call it the shock absorber itself. It's a hydraulic actuator, basically. Everything was expensive, so I think cost was that. But today, I mean, you got a lot of expensive things out there and high fidelity systems and so forth. So once you ride in a full active thing, you'll figure it out how to pay for it.
Hey, look, we got a lot more to get into, questions from the audience, topics we want to get into, other things, but we got to take a quick commercial break right now. In fact, you've heard of this company. It's called Lear.
Hey, one of my favorites.
Let's go to that now.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back talking with Don Runkel, with Phoebe Howard and Chris Pockert on Autoline After Hours. We got a number of questions in. Let's go through them real quick and get to some other topics. Mike Flowers wants to know, what do you think about solid-state batteries for electric cars?
Well, I think it's a terrific opportunity to continue to develop. I knew Anne Marie Sastry, a professor at University of Michigan. She sold her solid-state battery company,
SAC-D3 to Dyson. The vacuum cleaner company.
The vacuum cleaner company, but I heard he's making noise about maybe a vehicle or something.
He said he wants to get into electric cars.
So maybe this battery's better than I thought.
Yeah.
So I think, the electrolyte has always been the issue in batteries and fires and so forth. So solid-state batteries, I think, is a good one. But again, we're going to need pretty... at least a decimal point change in the cost of batteries and so forth to get it up into the area where it would really be a serious competitor to internal combustion engines and so forth. So I think there's the cost per kilowatt hour in gasoline, I think, is 7 cents, not $200.
Yeah.
So, thousand to one.
We got another one here. Albert.
So you can have a lot of inefficiency in internal combustion engine to make up for that.
Albert Maniscalco wants to know, what about improvements in terms of electric motors? And battery's got to improve. Yeah. He's wondering about motors. And he says, what are the pros and cons of using multiple motors?
Well, I think we did a number of concept vehicles. One was the HX3, which is a hybrid looking like a minivan, a hybrid vehicle that had motors in the wheels. And there's quite a bit of activity now with motors in the wheel. That's there's some downsides, but that's a good thing to look at. My feeling is the motor technology is fairly mature. Probably all the motor companies out there say, "Well, you haven't seen what's in my labs today," so which is true. But they've been developed quite handily out there, and I don't think it follows Moore's law by any means, where it's going to reduce in cost every 12 to 18 months in half. So I think it'll be more or less like today, but following the normal sort of 2-3% type cost reduction. But I think, obviously, electrification and electric motors allow you to patch up the weaknesses in the internal combustion engine, basically. The internal combustion engine is pretty good when it's running at its sweet spot, at its good efficiency point, where we rarely run it at. We almost always run it at its worst spot. And so, therefore, it is sort of this 20%, a lot of idling. And so now we fix that with engine off at idle. And but still fairly low power. The problem with the car with an internal combustion engine is you have to size the engine for F equals MA, force equals mass times acceleration. So you pick the mass of the vehicle, you pick the acceleration 0 to 60 and whatever. That tells you what the horsepower is. And you have to size the engine for that, even though you will use less than 10% of that almost all the time. So you got a 400 horsepower Suburban, you're going down the road, it takes, 40, 50 horsepower, but you got a 400 horsepower engine up there. And so you're running that at a very inefficient point. With electrification, you begin to use the electric motor and as little battery as you can get away with to handle the power part, but use gasoline for the energy part, which is these long, across the road for the next 500 miles. Hard to beat gasoline and energy density there.
Okay. Dale Leonard wants to know, what's your opinion of standard shift? And do you think it will ever make a comeback in the United States?
What's standard shift? You mean the standard transmission?
Manual transmission.
Manual transmissions.
Yeah, right. That's what I'm guessing he means.
Today's automatic or paddle shifting is so good. My son and I go out to Fellows Corvette Racing School every year, and we're heading out there again in April. And so we use manuals out there, but it's hard to beat the guys with automatics.
Automatics have gotten to be amazingly good.
They're amazing, and the rev matching on the on the manuals now are just give up heel and toe. It's not worth learning.
No.
So it was interesting when they launched the Bullet, the Mustang Bullet. Mm-hmm. And one huge issue that was really thought provoking for millennials in the market is when. Molly McQueen, she's in her 30s, had never driven a stick. Ford gave her lessons to learn for the ad that she made.
Yeah.
And she said it changed how she felt being in a vehicle.
Really?
So she's 30 years old, and she said her entire life, when she's in a car, she views the trip as going from point A to point B.
Just getting there.
just getting there. She said, having had the stick experience.
Now you're more engaged.
You're engaged. She said, it's fun. You're paying attention. Every single moment in the vehicle is, she said, she'd never talked to anyone about it, but it really changed how she viewed being in a car.
Yeah. That's a good point.
You're a lot more tied to the physics of the vehicle. You're a lot less likely to be a distracted driver. There's no unintended acceleration.
And a certain satisfaction on how you're.
Oh yeah, it's wonderful.
All that stuff.
But that's someone in their 30 years old had never had the experience.
And we should explain too. This is Steve McQueen's granddaughter.
Right. And had never had the experience. In fact, Ford brought her to Dearborn to shoot the spot and assumed she knew how to drive. And she's like, you've got the wrong person. I have no idea what to do. I'm really embarrassed. But it is amazing to think of how we think of the experience. And all of us have driven
That's
stick.
That's interesting because I have a 19-year-old son. He's an engineer down at the University of Michigan, mechanical. And so we were heading out to the Corvette Racing School for 3 days. And I said, Damien, you gotta get up to speed on manual transmissions because, he's... Like McQueen did.
Molly McQueen, yeah.
Really didn't know how to do it. I said, what's going to happen when your girlfriend's got a manual transmission, she throws you the keys, and you're going to sort of be down there looking at your shoes, trying to figure this out.
So the car companies, the both domestic and foreign, both have said it's a theft prevention. They've actually had situations where people jump into the vehicle to steal and they can't drive it. And it's a problem with valet,
I've run into that problem with valets who go, sir, I can't move the car.
And then you say, I can only park up front right there.
So anyway,
but the theft prevention is real. Some of the companies have talked about that.
I was going to teach my son how to drive manual, so I tried to get a manual. So you can't rent a manual. Not possible. Not possible. I was going to have to buy a car, teach him how to do that, and then sell the car, right? So a friend of mine said, hey, I have a Z06 with manual. You can have that for a week and teach
him. Well, that's a tough car to learn on because the clutch is so heavy.
I said, Damien, all you got to do is keep it in seventh gear. It doesn't need a transmission. This thing's got so much horsepower. But he picked it up right away and beat me at the race course out there.
Ooh,
the
fellow. So there you go.
Now is another sport I can't beat him at.
What was your first stick?
Oh, my first job while I was still in high school was washing the post office trucks for the City of Farmington post office.
And they were manual.
Wow. And I wanted to drive them. And they were right-hand steer. So I had to shift with my left hand. And I loved the job. It was the best job. They paid me 50 cents for every truck that I washed. And I was in pig heaven.
My first stick was a right-hand drive, also a Triumph TR2, right-hand drive. And, you got to shift with your left hand. It's a stick, so I was 15 at the time and bought this TR2. And then a Volkswagen Beetle with manual transmission.
How about you, Chris?
Mine came a bit later, but it was an 86 Jetta GLI Eurospec, and it was my first car. I took my driving test on it.
Phoebe, you drive a stick?
Supra, yeah.
Supra.
A Porsche and a Supra. Those are the only ones I've ever done.
And you're golden in my book.
both manual.
And short-lived, let me point out, short-lived. But it's an amazing, I love that experience. And I stopped driving after, when you're in San Francisco Hills, it's terrifying to be in complete control.
Yeah.
You really don't.
My son got the biggest kick out of it after he got used to it after a day or two. I says, okay, Damon, now we're going to do some shifting without the clutch. And so I said, just feel it now. And just, so then he's driving all over the town, just no clutch other than starting and stopping.
That's great. Hey, I want to get into jumping topics completely right now. The Super Bowl was last weekend. There was all kinds of advertising. Car companies especially throw tons at it. And Phoebe, I know this is something that's near and dear to your heart. You've really been following it. What stands out in your mind?
Consumer
behavior. Whatever.
So here's a couple strange points, because I do like to track consumer behavior specifically related to cars and purchasing power. So Lexus and Jeep and Kia dominated both brand and specific models, meaning people watched the ads and they hopped on the computer and they went and looked at all Kia vehicles and they went and looked at all Jeep vehicles and they went and looked at all Lexus vehicles. And then they had different data where they went for the specific vehicles as well. Interestingly, Ram performed horribly. So people saw the ad and no one looked it up. So that was the one of the worst. That was actually the worst performance.
Jeep?
Jeep did incredibly well.
I loved it.
Both the Wrangler and the Cherokee.
Well, that was a great ad because it was as simple as the vehicle is, right? It was one shot. There was no soundtrack. There was just the steady voice of the announcer. And it was just all the way through, and it was just, that is a Jeep. That's exactly what it was. It was perfect.
And the, what else we found that's really interesting is that consumers still think that Dodge owns the Ram. So people will now Google Dodge to look for a Ram, and obviously the companies have been separated for now 9 years. So it's really interesting. How do you advertise something like that? How do you market a vehicle that people are doing searches for your vehicle under the wrong company name?
We're Ram. Don't search Dodge.
Yeah.
I will say, as a journalist, we have to protect for that. Yeah, with SEO, we might tweak a headline or a slug that you don't see in the headline of the article that has both Ram and Dodge, because we know that people look for everything.
Yeah, we have to, and it's amazing. If any journalist, any media outlet posts a story that doesn't say Dodge about Ram, your readership, your viewership plummets. So you actually have to account for consumer misunderstanding.
Well, does FCA flip you over when you go into the Dodge thing to flip you over to Ram?
There's a strategy opportunity there. But yeah, Lexus did incredibly well, and frankly, Jeep did just off the charts.
Jeep did, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, really so good. Very, very well.
And going back to the Ram ad, though, there was a lot of controversy because they used part of a speech of Martin Luther King, and a lot of people were offended that they were using his remarks to sell trucks. And if you look at his full speech, it was against, stupid spending over, consumers spending stupidly, including on cars and things like that.
Like unbelievable.
But does that hurt them at all?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. In fact, that's a really good question because some people said, is any publicity good publicity? If people are talking about how pitiful your ad campaign is that good because they're talking about you? No. Because we know that they're talking about you and they're mocking you and they're ridiculing you, but they're not going to look up the vehicle. They're doing no research. Mm-hmm. So we know that people go to dealerships less frequently. They used to make 5 trips. They now make 1 to buy a car. They do all the research, and they show up and say, these are the 3 things. Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
And so dealers love that. But this really was an opportunity missed. It's $5 million for 30 seconds. They said
that does not include the cost of the ad, which could easily be another $5 million.
Easily. Mm-hmm. And they said they did it just for that Super Bowl spot, other than online penetration. Yeah. So it was a big loss, I think, for Ram. Too bad.
Mm. Yeah.
Embarrassing. And yeah.
Very much so. Chris, did any ads stand out in your mind?
Well, the Jeep ad is the one that stood out. Right at the end, it was sort of a surprise. I think that took place in the third or fourth quarter, and I was just, I didn't expect it to come along. We knew that there were going to be a suite of ads from them. And just how simple it was in comparison to all the other ads, including that Ram ad. And about that Ram ad, there was, within, I think, 12 hours, there was a recut version of that ad with Martin Luther King's complete speech that applies to that, and him talking about how people are tempted to spend money on cars and they're tempted, advertising being a very untrustworthy and sort of difficult subject. And it was perfectly re-executed. And then my understanding is that Ram quickly had that taken down because it was using their intellectual property.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
I thought the dancing ad was the best one, but I can't remember what they were selling.
You liked the dirty dancing spot?
Oh, yeah, it was great. But I can't remember.
I'm having trouble remembering, too. Can you remember
pitching?
What it was?
I didn't see the ad.
The NFL?
They weren't advertising. I can't remember what they were advertising. It was two
I thought
football.
It was NFL. No? I didn't know who it was. So much for the ad.
So funny.
It was funny.
That is funny. Hey, look, we got to take another quick commercial break. Speaking of commercials, we have got to take a commercial break, and this time we're giving a good shout out to our friends at Bridgestone.
Bridgestone Drive Guard tires are engineered to come through in the clutch.
Let's go!
And NFL coach John Gruden is going to help us prove it.
I got this.
Okay, tires. If you take a hit, you got to get back up.
John,
you better kick it up a notch and get us home.
There's always going to be nails on the road to victory, but you keep on going.
Actually, DriveGuard tires can take a puncture and drive up to 50 miles to safety.
50 miles?
Yep.
Guess my pep talk worked.
Sure.
Okay, we're back after hours talking all things automotive. We sort of left off with the Super Bowl ads, but the greatest, most incredible automotive stunt of all time took place this week as well, with the Falcon Heavy being launched by SpaceX and putting a Tesla Roadster into space. So, Phoebe, you take it from there, because you've been following all the Super Bowl ads and the like. What do you make of this as a publicity stunt?
Brilliant. Simply brilliant.
Right.
I mean, we talked to families and all the people were gathered around the television. It was like a Kennedy moment, watching the launch and people talking about it. It's sort of shocking how many people in America paid attention and engaged. And this goes to the branding that you talked about. Are people buying a Tesla because they want a car, or are they buying a Tesla because they want to harness something different? And this is space travel. So I think that he's spot on with brand. Having said that, I talked to Tesla wannabe owners who are waiting for delivery of their vehicle. And they were very irritated by this. They weren't amused and they weren't delighted. They just said, all the energy focusing on going to space, we'd like some production. Give us our car. Yeah. You've got the money. We'd like our car now.
I can't buy a rocket. Give me my car. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Building cars in quantities hard.
I thought the best part of that I watched the whole 30-minute launch. It was really great. And having all the employees on the air pitching it and the enthusiasm of it, it must have been a great recruiting tool for
It was electrifying. Yeah.
It was electrifying.
The crowds, and they were just cheering the whole time. I get goosebumps just thinking about it. It was unbelievable.
Wow. Because my wife's in there, I said, you got to watch this. I mean, this is terrific. But I thought the greatest part was sticking the landing of those two boosters. I said, this is Hollywood. He's making this up. They came down, they stuck it.
But the other thing that was fascinating is I spoke to an investor who watches the Detroit 3 and Tesla and said, we hold the Detroit auto companies to a different standard because Detroit isn't expected to take things into space. And when you're taking things into space, we give you leeway on how much money you lose and how we hold you accountable.
Hey, GM only provided the lunar rover.
Yeah, we put the first ones up there.
Yeah. Very important point.
That's right. Speaking of Tesla, we have another phone call. Carmen, let's bring that one in.
Hey, guys, this is Youngblood, Cleveland, Ohio. My comment is to Johnny Mac. Hey, thanks for calling out those Tesla Model 3 groupies that are saying that you're picking on that vehicle. Hey, nowadays cars are made fantastically well. If that's not the case with their precious Tesla, you know, Musk promised them the moon. I mean, the Mars. I mean, you know, whatever he promised. And they should hold them to it like you suggested. Thank you for calling them out, and go team. Later. Bye.
All right. Thanks for that, young blood. Yeah, what he's talking to is on Autoline Daily. I think it was yesterday I had said, you know, that we put out a video working with Sandy Monroe that pointed out a lot of manufacturing flaws on the Model 3. And, of course, The Tesla fanboys came out of the hills to attack us, pitchforks and torches and all that. And so I made a comment about that on yesterday's show saying, look, you fanboys out there, don't do Tesla any favors when you pat them on the back for a job poorly done. You should be demanding excellence from this company, because if it does not execute flawlessly, this company is going to fail. And, you know, listen, Don, I was equally as critical of GM back in the day, sure, when it was turning out a lot of bad quality stuff.
And that criticism helped the company.
It helps the company, exactly, yeah, right. So, I mean, there are people out there who just want to tear down Tesla because they just want to tear down Tesla. They hate Elon and the like. We're pointing out facts. And if you can't deal with the facts, get out of the kitchen, so to speak. But I really think that they need to stand up, and the Tesla fans need to stand up and demand excellence from this company, because what it's turning out right now is not acceptable in automotive terms. So anyway, there you go.
No. Interesting how they got to the point where they're not as good in the manufacturing, have not gotten good in manufacturing so far.
Except that people who have them love them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Love them. They'll stop you in a parking lot and talk to you about their vehicle unsolicited. You don't want to hear about the vehicle, but they're going to tell you about the vehicle anyway. I mean, it's quite amazing.
No. Hey, look, the car is really cool. And as we've talked about here, they've introduced things that nobody's caught up to them on yet. But I believe, they need to have that stock price high. They need to be able to leverage that to get the money that they need that's not being generated through profits, because there are no profits at the company. And I think they rushed this car to market. It's not developed. It's not finished. They'll get it fixed in time. You know, sometime later this year, they'll start turning out decent quality cars. But, boy, anybody else would have had their heads chopped off. So we'll see how they pull it off.
There's a lot of capability out there. I'm surprised that they did not tap into the people that know how to make cars. Forget whether it's a Tesla or something like that. There's lots of people in the Detroit area, the Frankfurt area, the Japan and so forth, that know how to do cars. And you just got to hire them and put them on the job, so to speak.
I think they had those people, Don, and I
don't think they did in the manufacturing arena nearly enough.
Maybe, but
Elon's credit, because I was out looking at Elon's car when it was just the two passenger kicking tires for one of the investors. And, we came back, and Musk is in this meeting with us, and he said, "What do you think?" I said, "Your car is terrible." it was a prototype. It was the Lotus conversion, so to speak. He said, "My recommendation is," I said, "it's neat. Anybody can do a two-passenger car that's high performance. This is not hard to do. This is straightforward. But to make it a great car takes some expertise." And I suggested, go to one of those three cities and find people that know how to make cars. Keep whatever proprietary technology you think you have private. But to get the doors to work and the seats to work and all that other stuff, that's all been solved a million times. Get those people and do it. To his credit, the cars came out. They had very high consumer reports on the initial Teslas. So he did that. I was surprised, given all their issues in manufacturing, that somehow they must not have gotten the same quality of manufacturing capability.
I have a different theory. I think Elon said, we don't need to PPAP this thing, no pre-production
things.
Yeah,
that's true.
We don't have to have our tooling suppliers do tryouts before they ship the stuff to us. Just get the cars made. Mm-hmm. Because he's made all these promises to investors that we're going to start building these things and everything's going to go through the roof in terms of sales and profits and all that. I lay the blame right at his feet, because I'm sure he had people telling him, "Elon, no, we've got to do PPAP. We got to do pre-production. We got to test this stuff." And they didn't do any of that. Mm-hmm.
But I think
so now they're learning on the fly how to build a good
that's
car.
That's an expensive time to learn.
It is, when you have to manually build parts of the car, or your supply chain's not quite right. I think his ambition is so absolute, and his authority is so absolute, and his timetables are so short, in part because they're not making money and because they need to appeal to their investors and they have to deliver right away. And they're coming from the tech culture where, you put things out and then you issue bug fixes thereafter, right? You beta test in public. Mm-hmm. That's not the car model normally.
That's right.
And they've gotten away with that to this point, and I think they've been able to do that with higher end customers with things like the S and X, because the people that can afford those cars can afford to be inconvenienced if the car goes away to the dealer for a while because they have other cars and because there are so few cars in general in circulation that their service network could handle that. Now, when you ramp that with the Model 3 and you have all those additional vehicles in the system, and by the way, building 100,000 cars versus building 500,000 cars a year is very different. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be their chief challenge. And I think they baked in some problems into the way that they built the 3, and certainly the way that they built the X, those doors. I mean, we've heard Elon admit pretty much he would never do them again.
Yeah.
And I think he's learning. It's just a question of how quickly will they learn versus the pace of everybody else coming in with their product.
And it's not just the car, it's the batteries. They have huge problems at the Gigafactory trying to assemble the battery packs. So, hey, we've got another phone call here. Let's bring that in, Carmen.
This is Clark. Clem Zarovsky in Delmont, Pennsylvania. One of the reasons I believe the Corvette needs a mid-engine car is for the race team. They have to run a lot of rear wing downforce to get traction, and that kills their straightaway speed. That's why, like at the 24-hour Daytona, the Fords killed them because they had so much more straightaway speed. Because of their mid-engine configuration, they didn't need as much rear wing downforce. Thank you. Bye. Yeah.
Thanks for that. Your thoughts, Don?
Stay tuned. Daytona was an anomaly.
Well, a lot of that has got to do with the balance of performance that IMSA gives to each team, and that'll change for the next race.
Yes, I ran racing at both Buick, and not, I didn't, but a guy that worked for me ran racing, and any time we lost something like that, you'd be in the organizer's office the next day arguing for rule changes. So either you take mass out, you change the wing, or do something like that. So I don't know. Certainly we knew the straightaway speeds were going to be a little lower than expected, but I think they did okay during qualifying and so forth. So we'll see how they do in the next race.
They'll probably do a whole lot better because of that balance of performance.
Yeah, yeah. They need to make it competitive, and they like to change it around, the organizers do.
Yeah, one last topic I think we ought to touch on is we saw some management shuffle. I wouldn't call it a shakeup at all at FCA, Fiat Chrysler. And we saw Tim Kuniskis now being given all of Alfa Romeo and Maserati worldwide to run, and Reid Biglin having given up those two jobs to concentrate on sales. And Phoebe, you're nodding your head there. What do you make of what's going on here?
Well, I think it's notable that the change happened after the big launches, Alfa Romeo and Maserati. So obviously, Reid Biglin did a good job. I mean, the company's happy. They want him to focus now on U.S. sales, North American sales. That's the heart of the business for them. And so with successful launches of Giulia, in the Stelvia, I think that speaks to focus. It goes to your point that Fiat Chrysler is positioned beautifully going into 18 and 19, would you say?
Yeah, I think they're going to have a good year this year because, you know, Jeep had a bad year last year, but a lot of that was dropping a model, doing manufacturing changeover at the plants and losing production that way. I think they're going to make that all up this year.
And they have a lot more capacity coming on also in the Ram.
In the Ram, they have a full assembly plant additional capacity coming on for Ram. I'm thinking, my prediction is...
In the middle of a changeover at GM. So. And
that the Ram is going to outsell the Silverado this year. GM's not buying it. But Chris, what do you think of the change?
I would argue that they're well-positioned for Ram and for Jeep. I would honestly question how successful the launch of Alfa has been, and certainly Maserati. If you look, Maserati had a short peak of sales with their models, and then they went in the toilet. And I would argue that the lift that we've seen, it's too early on Stelvio, right? But that should be the volume product. Those vehicles have been known to have widespread quality issues, even by FCA standards, pardon me. But I would argue that those brands are not where they need to be. Fiat is, most of their product isn't moving at all. I think, you know, the American stuff is going to hold the fort and improve things for them. I think all of the Italian brands are in real serious trouble.
But the American stuff, all the North, that's driving the whole company and has been driving the whole company. So I think shifting the executive attention to the U.S. sales, North American sales, is the key. But also the question when you talk about things not doing well with Maserati and Alfa Romeo, how much of that is just, it's a brand that they didn't sink much advertising into it. It's not reaching the American consumer, really?
That could be part of it. I'm sure it's part of it.
Right.
But they brought out the Levante, the SUV, which really should play to a much broader audience.
For Maserati.
Yeah, for Maserati than it already is. The reviews, the critical reviews on that, the quality control issues, none of that has gone terribly well for them, I would argue. And I think that problem persists throughout all of their Italian brands, or is more acute in those than in their domestic brands. And I think it's a real problem. I think they put a lot of eggs in those baskets when they were doing things like delaying the Ram 1500 to focus on launching Alpha and all that. And you cut the profits out of the company when you do things like that.
Yeah. No, I don't see how Fiat can survive in the U.S. market. Elsewhere, sure, Europe, Latin America, the like, it's doing okay. But I don't see how their dealers are going to survive with the volume that they've got. You just can't run a store selling only a couple of cars a week on average. And so I'm with you on that one, Chris. What else? Anything else? Oh, Phoebe, this is another topic that you wanted to talk about. Mercedes-Benz got in big trouble in China because it did something with the Dalai Lama. And why don't you pick it up from there?
So it mentioned, so Mercedes-Benz was cited right after Delta, right after Marriott. And so you have the Chinese government.
Wait. You mentioned Delta and Marriott. What was that?
Delta Airlines and Marriott for similar things. So
with Dalai Lama or something?
So Mercedes-Benz simply put out a message with an inspirational quote citing the Dalai Lama, who's a leader of Tibet, of course. And the Dalai Lama is not to be mentioned or discussed in China. He's viewed as a separatist, and it's a really big problem. And so Mercedes-Benz has apologized repeatedly. From a government standpoint in China, that can get companies in big trouble. So the U.S. companies are stepping very carefully with the words they use, the language they use, how you talk about the government, how you talk about the Dalai Lama, even mentioning Tibet, how you talk about Taiwan. So if you're a Detroit-based company or you're running Mercedes-Benz, you may think putting out an inspirational quote really is a nice thing to do. And it caused tremendous backlash and can actually result in punishment or loss of visas for executives and business leaders. So it's very serious. Very serious.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Man. Yeah.
I mean, when it's the largest auto market, you would think that there might be more. I questioned, actually, I made calls last week on business training. How are our businesses being trained to know what they can and can't say? You can't say anything about the government, and you can't say anything about the military. That's not what a lot of companies are used to, or executives.
You need a political correction department.
Okay, our work. Thanks for sending in your question here. Talk about a Katie's engine. So you worked on Ecomotor, which was another opposed piston engine that it didn't work, right?
Or, I mean, at the end of the day,
the company didn't work.
Yeah. And I think I was happy to see, actually, Katie's making some progress. It's also an opposed piston configuration. The architecture of the Katie's engine is an old architecture that goes back to the Luftwaffe flying the Yonkers engine, which was opposed pistons, because it got the fuel economy to fly to England from Germany. So it worked, and that's the late 30s, so to speak. So Katie's went down that path, and then I think they made good progress in terms of emissions and getting good fuel economy and so forth. And now they've tied up with Aramco, I think, for a venture. So they'll have, you know, a good flow of money there, some funding in there. I think the architecture, the thing that fascinated me at Ecomotors, which is where I was CEO for a number of years, was our architecture was a different architecture. It was opposed pistons, opposed cylinders. It was perfectly balanced. And it had lots of good characteristics there, if we could get it all to work. But I think at the end of the day, the architecture, it had these outer pistons connected with long connecting rods. And we couldn't get those pistons to behave. And so you'd have scuffing issues and stuff like that. So that took a lot of effort and time to do that. And I think at the end of the day, I left after 4 or 5 years there, and they continued for a few more years. But I was glad to see at least the opposed piston idea has some merit in terms of, and certainly two-cycle engines have some merit. That's a confounding one that I've never understood quite why there was not more development in the two-cycle arena. There's lots of advantages to them. Power density is generally higher. They're way less expensive. They have a hell of a lot less parts, no valvetrain, no camshafts and timing belts and all those sort of things. So it'll be interesting to see how Katie's develops there. I was hopeful our architecture at Ecomotors, that was the fundamental patent we had from Professor Hofbauer.
Okay. I'm trying to end the show, but I keep getting things here. So, number one, the control room just sent me a message. Katie's CEO David Johnson, going to be on this show March 8th.
Okay.
And he's told me he's going to let me drive that F-150 with the engine.
Yeah, it's got a three-cylinder posed piston. It's got, you know, pretty good horsepower density.
When you
right
go
over.
And look at the engines, when you go and look at the, I hope you have a chance to swing by and look at the work that they're doing at Aramco with this project. Mm, mm-hmm. It's quite phenomenal, actually, all the detailed engine work and the research. And I've never seen, it's unbelievable.
Okay. A lot of our engineers from Eco Motors ended up at Katie's
after. Okay, and we have one more phone call, and then we are going to end the show. So don't anybody else write in or call in. And Carmen, let's take this last one.
I want to thank Mr. Runkle for his perspective on the future of cars. I remember a while back when Mr. Lutz was on, he said everything was going to be electric. I don't believe that. I agree with Mr. Runkle. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for the phone call.
Lutz is one of my best friends, and we'll be out.
You have a bunch of late night dinner party arguments.
One coming out next week. And he's the chairman of a mostly an electric vehicle company, Via Motors, outside of Salt Lake City, and I'm a director at that company. So we just signed a deal with Geely in China to bring our technology into that. And they got a lot of wherewithal and a very exciting company, actually, Geely is. So we'll see how that goes. China's very committed to electrification. And we have both versions, plug-in hybrid as well as full electric at Via. So we'll see how that goes. It's a busy market right now with those sort of things, and we're still also doing fundraising for that company.
Yeah, just don't put any Dalai Lamas in your answer
promotion. Well, I'm glad we learned a lot after. We'll call you up with any press releases and make sure we get this right.
Keep me posted.
We just had one go out last week, so I have to go back and reread it now.
You have to say, don't commit news. Travel safely and don't commit news.
Don Runkle, thanks so much for coming on the
show. Pleasure.
Great to be able to pick your brain on so many things.
As
Phoebe
always.
Howard, great having you. Chris Packard. We'll have you back again, too.
Wonderful to be here, as always.
Good. And as always, I want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine This Week. There's all that and much more at AutoLine.tv.